Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey guys, welcome to a great and interesting edition of TFL Talk. And with me today is my man Nathan. Thanks
Howdy
for joining
us. Hope you guys are having a great week.
Yeah, we're not. We've had quite the week, actually. If you've been watching some of our videos, you know that I had a little issue with the Hummer. And we'll talk about that first. But what's this podcast about mainly, Nathan?
So this podcast, if you're not watching, there's a Mustang 2 on the screen here, and there's a very good reason for that. Essentially, we are talking about vehicles that you guys love, but the worst versions of some of these vehicles you guys love. And we obviously want you to chime in and let us know whether or not you agree with us and also what you would add or maybe subtract from this list. So we're going to hit that in just a minute. But first, we need to talk about the disastrous day that Roman had with our $115,000 Hummer, which broke down in the middle of the road while it was raining, and it wouldn't go into neutral to be pushed.
Yeah, exactly right. And I do want to thank the fine writers over at Jalopnik for helping put together this list. We're going to comment on it. But let's talk about the Hummer. So me, you, and Andre were driving back from the, well, it's an airfield, after drag racing the Hummer against the Cadillac Escalade V.
Yeah.
Which was, by the way, a car that everybody tried to grab the keys for here.
It's a hoot. It's like a gangster, an angry vehicle. I've never met a Cadillac with a bigger chip on its shoulder. It just is pissed off constantly.
I think it's the most expensive car the GM builds. The sticker on it was $150,000, right?
Which is insane. But what you're paying for really is the Blackwing powertrain, right?
It's a supercharged V8, puts out 685 horsepower?
Something like that, yeah.
Does that sound right to you? Yeah.
It sounds about right. And they may have actually undercut it, too. I mean, the thing weighs a lot, but it is ridiculously fast. But it's still a classic Cadillac. They managed to keep the recipe and still make this thing into an absolute beast.
Yeah, I know. And so we thought, hey, you know, this is about as fun of a vehicle as you can have. So let's go and drag race it against our brand new Hummer, which we had just picked up at the dealership. So that was our very first video. And by the way, if you're watching AllTFL, .com, where we have all these videos, you'll note that there are other videos with Hummers. It just happened that GM lent us a Hummer at the exact same time that we took delivery of our Hummer. So we actually had two Hummers at the office.
And they looked identical.
Yeah, they're all
because
white.
They're all white and black, essentially, mostly white.
First editions are all white.
Right. And so that's why it looks the same. We had no choice in the matter.
And make matters worse, we got our spec with the spare tire, and the one the GM gave us had the spare tire.
Yeah. It really, you'll be hard-pressed to tell the difference, except for the fact that the one that GM loaned us didn't break down on the road. The one we bought did.
So we're driving it back from the drag race. And if you want to see that, go to alltfl.com. It's a fun drag race, actually.
It is. So before we leap into this.
Before the the 10
I
models.
I would like to quickly recognize our Patreon viewers.
Oh, yeah. Go for it.
Guys, thank you very much for chiming in. Today, we don't have any comments. But normally speaking, when you go to TFL Car, which is where our Patreon is, that's the only account we have. If you send us a message through Patreon, we will answer it directly, either in this facility or perhaps in another one. But you kind of go ahead of the line, if you know what I mean. So thank you guys for your support. Without your support, we couldn't do what we do.
Especially the podcast.
Yes, especially the podcast.
Yeah, because that really helps, you know, pay for your time and my time and The videographer's time and the editor's time.
Well, where else am I going to get my hair styled if I don't have that Patreon money?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's important. So before we start this list, I wanted to point out something. There are a lot of cars on this list that actually could be relatively inexpensive collectibles.
Hold on. I got to read this letter. I got a mean letter.
Oh, you got a mean letter?
Oh, I got a really mean letter.
Oh, well, read the mean letter.
Oh, God. I love responding to these guys. As I said, this has been a hell of a week. Because the other thing that happened was both Fox News and Alex Jones used their videos to make political points with the Hummer. But that's a whole other story. We also have a video that addresses that.
We're not political, guys. That's the whole point of TFL. We're cars and we're trucks.
We don't do politics.
No, we would try to stay out of it. So we did do a video about that, but that video essentially is just pointing out that they used our stuff and we really would – rather.
Somebody actually said that they've unsubscribed now that we've mentioned Alex Jones. We didn't. He used our stuff.
We're just talking about who's using our stuff.
Yeah, we put it out there. People use it however they want.
Yeah, BBC's used our stuff. NBC's used our stuff.
Yeah.
Almost every major network has.
CBS Sunday Morning News used our stuff.
A lot of times. And we've been on Colorado Public Radio several times. And we mention that every time. So the point is that we're mentioning everything when people use our stuff because we're trying to be transparent. And we do not want to be politically aligned with either group, so we don't care about that. All we care about is getting you the news.
Anyway, so we're driving back from this drag race, and I get this. You're ahead of me. We're all driving together, and we pull into Longmont in the middle of the truck rush hour traffic. I'm in a double left lane, and there's this message that pops up that basically says you need to service your steering rack and your autonomous emergency braking is now offline. I'm like, you know what? I'll just cycle the truck. Basically, it's a long line waiting to make a left turn. I'll just stop. I'll hit the power button like a computer, right, or
turn
a phone.
Reboot it.
Reboot it, basically. And I did that, and guess what happened? It didn't reboot. It got locked in park. And it wouldn't go into neutral, it wouldn't go into drive, it wouldn't go into reverse, no matter what I did. And the way you would normally fix that is you would pull the battery, right?
Mm-hmm.
But because...
Well, you should probably tell everybody what the battery you're referring to, because there's two batteries,
essentially. All electric cars have two batteries. They have the high voltage battery, which is the one that's used to propel the vehicle.
Which is usually lithium ion or something along those lines.
Right. And then they have a traditional 12 volt, which operates things like hazards, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
Or the OS, which is bad.
Right. So essentially, just like a regular gas-powered vehicle, the 12-volt battery powers a lot of the essentials on board.
Yes.
Without actually being used for power, to make it move.
Move the truck with it. So normally what you would do is, in this case, the battery is under the hood,
mm-hmm.
And you would pop the hood and you would just, pull one of the terminal leads and it would hopefully reboot the system.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to do that by opening the hood and the button didn't work and the fob didn't work. Basically, the hood was not going to open.
Because it's electric release.
Because it's operated by the OS, which is now locked up. It started to rain, and a guy came by and said, "Hey, I'll tow you out of the way." And I was like, "Thank you, but you're not going to move a 9,500-pound truck that's in park."
Yeah, essentially, it's a 9.5-pound paperweight now.
Exactly right.
It's absolutely useless. You can't do anything with it.
Dude, you know what was really stressing me out? There was a girl behind me. This happened a lot. So I have my hazards on, and they're bright. They're LED hazards, basically, right? And this girl, sat there, through three traffic light cycles waiting for me to move, thinking that I had my turn signal on. And then when she was back there, people would, there was a 2-mile backup behind her, even though I'm in a double left so people could go around her. And I had to eventually get out of the truck and say, "Look, I'm not going anywhere."
Yeah.
And she was buried in her phone. She was completely oblivious.
Completely oblivious to what you were
terrifying
doing.
Terrifying if you ride motorcycles. Terrifying.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. Right, because if this person doesn't even sits through three light cycles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Red, green, red, green, red,
right,
green.
Right.
That probably took 5 minutes, and is unaware that I'm stuck. Imagine what that means if you're out there. Anyway, that's a whole other
thing. She would look right through the rider and run into him, most likely. So there's a lot of people.
So I had to tell her. I was "Girl, I'm not going anywhere.
Go around, please." And did you have the direct traffic after she moved to go around you?
Yeah, and then eventually Tommy came to rescue me, and what we figured out, and tow truck driver came, what we figured out was that there was this little tiny cable buried way under the driver's footwell that would, if you pulled on it not once, but twice, it would release the hood, which then allowed you to pull the terminal on the battery,
mm-hmm.
and then the system reset, then we could actually put the truck in drive.
And so you were able to get out of there once you did that. It's a little tiny loop That's a tiny cable. It doesn't even look like it goes to anything.
So one of the things that we pride ourselves, as you know, Nathan, on is that we're always transparent.
Yeah.
Right? So whenever something like this happens, it's real-world reviews. We've done that for 12 years now. So we roll the camera.
Yeah.
So we show everything, my stress, my stupidity, you know, the driver's error, the truck error, whatever it is, we show it, you know, warts and all.
Right.
Because that's what we do. We're transparent. So this morning after, you know, a very stressful week, I get this email from a guy called Matt, right? So this is what he wrote. And he's referring to you as well. So
yeah, please.
Keep this in mind, okay? So Matt, I'm going to read your email, okay? Maybe when dealing with technologies, you don't understand an engineering processes that you don't understand. That's because neither of you are engineers. Maybe you should read the owner's manual for these EV vehicles and not presume that an EV would function like a simple laptop or that you can get in one of these cars and drive them. So we have to read the owner's manual first.
Before we drive them, that's work.
Because really everybody does that.
How many, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, wait, I haven't done that at all. Okay, keep going.
Having listened to many of your podcasts, so thank you for listening, Matt, and watch your videos, your lack of knowledge as it pertains to electric vehicles and fuel economy standards and the reasons behind the government policies is not only offensive, it's actually dangerous, Nathan. It's dangerous. We're dangerous.
Okay. Does he say why?
As you are aware, with a listener base that is even more ignorant than you guys are. So
now he's insulting everybody else.
And you guys out there,
Matt, you're on everybody's Christmas list. Keep going.
Please educate yourself about these things you talk about as you have a big influence on the automotive world in this country.
Mm, okay. Real quick, couple things. Matt, exactly what do you want us to refresh our minds on? Do you want to talk about amperage? Do you want to talk about wattage? Do you want to talk about how much these cars cost? Do you want to talk about whether or not the batteries are properly sealed? What do you want to talk to us about? Because there are a couple things you should probably know. Between Roman and I, just the two of us in here, we've driven probably 1,000 cars.
I think we've driven every car on the market
pretty much
in the last 12
years. Yeah, and we've talked to the engineers who actually build them.
That's what I wrote to them.
Now, there's an important thing. You're right. I personally am quite ignorant in terms of a lot of the components that go into the vehicle. And from time to time, I screw up, you know, wattage and amperage and everything else and try to get it wrong. Kilowatt hour versus kilowatt. I mess that up sometimes. I'm still learning. I admit that. And I admit that to you guys. On top of that, I've owned an electric vehicle, my own, and I'm curious whether or not you own one, for over 2 years. And I've learned a lot about it. And I've educated people the best I can on that. So, Matt, your mother says that you really should write nicer letters that perhaps have smaller words for idiots like us. I'm sorry, Roman. Go ahead.
Thank you, Nathan. Yeah. I figured you would have the appropriate,
and I
agree.
That
was the appropriate word. So let me just...
Nothing but love, Matt. Mwah.
Let me just unpack this, first of all, just from my point of view, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, normally we get a lot of, like, nasty emails, but there's a line, and this letter crosses, and that line is when you start to impugn our credibility.
Or saying that we're dangerous.
Yeah.
That's a load of crap.
You know, or you know, question our professionalism or question, you know, the standards that we run by, which you clearly not only crossed, but you crossed and jumped over in a very, I would say...
malicious?
Rude way.
Yeah.
In a very rude way. So first and foremost, dear Matt, do you know what happens when the OS locks up on the Hummer EV?
No, he doesn't, because he doesn't drive
I would bet he doesn't own one.
No, you don't own one.
And Matt, do you know where and in what form the owner's manual is in the Hummer EV? Take a guess, Nathan. Do you think it's a paper owner's manual, or do you think that it's maybe one of those newfangled electronic owner's manual that is in the OS?
So here's a fun point.
What do you think happens when it locks up?
For the past 5 years, automakers have been getting, many of them have gotten rid of the actual physical owner's manual.
Which I hate, by the way.
I do.
I actually
agree with you.
When I get a car, the first thing I do is I dig into the owner's manual. I don't read
especially when we buy them.
Yeah, you can't read 500 pages of, like, you know, make sure you go and service your vehicle every 15
minutes. But what the rest of the viewers and listeners should probably know is that a lot of automakers are now doing OS. Not even online. They just do it inside the car, so it's buried inside the vehicle. So if you cannot access the OS system, you cannot read the manual. But more importantly, if the manual is not there, then you're not going to sit in your car for 3 hours
in traffic
and click through pages. Now, I do admit, you're right about one thing. Buying a new car, one of the first things we really should do is look over the manual for basic things. But honestly, who would have expected the vehicle to go into this mode and then completely die and then not allow him to go into a secondary mode of any sort to get out of that type of incident?
Actually, I tried to go into what's called safe mode.
Right, and it did nothing, right?
It did nothing.
So bottom line, Matt, and you know, for any other viewer who feels that, yes, we do make mistakes all the time, but we're real about it, and we're honest about it, and that's one of the big differences. And Matt, seriously, if you don't like what we do, if you feel like the information we're providing is wrong, there are other people you can watch and listen to.
Yeah, okay. Feel free.
Let's move on. Matt's gotten enough attention. So the bottom line is that you do have a point. If there was a manual to read, perhaps we should just sit down while we're on the toilets, where I always read my manuals, and look at them.
Is that why they're so stinky?
Yeah, well, they tend to, I wash my hands. But the point is that it's when they're embedded in the car, I know they're trying to save trees. I get it. But I really wish...
I think it's a bad idea.
It's a terrible idea, but I think what they should do is they should highlight, laminate a few pages, and just highlight the basics.
I mean, how are you going to read it on the toilet if it's in the car?
I know. Well, exactly. And then, if you're, Matt, if you're saying, oh, but you can find it online, you know what? Not necessarily. Tommy had to dig a lot in order to find how to actually pop the hood. You know what I mean? You guys actually had to go scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll. It wasn't that easy to access.
Here's an idea, Nathan.
Yeah.
Why don't you just put a traditional hood release? Like a little lever that every car for the last, 50 years had? Wouldn't that be something?
It's more than 50, I think, too.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just suggesting that to GM.
I know. Okay. Let's move on, because we have this whole thing with these cars that are apparently dangerous, because we're going to mention them to our audience. So shall we start with this? Now, these are the most, some of the most important / popular cars in some cases.
Yeah, yeah.
These are the worst versions of them. And there's a lot of other ones that we could mention that we're not going to mention in this list, but we just wanted to go on a couple colorful ones.
And at the end of this, we're also going to give you our best picks for winter cars, because winter is coming. So,
We're going to throw that in.
We're going to do a whole
hog on this.
Yeah. So this list comes to us from Jalopnik. So thank you, Jalopnik.
We kind of picked little pieces out of it. We didn't use all of their stuff, and we don't necessarily agree with it. But I wanted to. This does come from Jalopnik, but it comes from their viewers, their readers. So these cars actually are quoted by their readers as the ones that they picked.
Can I give you a recent stink at Ford? Because we're on, let's talk about this car.
Okay.
So this is the Mustang II.
You're right. This is the Ford Mustang II. They were essentially built between 73 and 78, and they are considered by many to be the absolute worst Mustang built.
And as you guys know, the first Mustang came out in 64 and a half.
Right.
And it's been built continuously until today, where Ford just introduced, I want to say it's, is it seventh or eighth generation?
I think it's the seventh or something like
that. I think it's eight, might be eight. Anyway, once again, there's a lot of numbers.
Not a huge difference between the prior generation and this one.
So they introduced at the LA Auto Show, and there was a bit of a stink. There were two topics that actually caused some stink about this issue. The first one was that a lot of the journalists felt that the newest version of the Mustang, the latest generation, wasn't a new generation at all, but it was a serious refresh. So usually the way that you designate a generation is you have a new chassis.
Mm-hmm.
But in this current generation that was just introduced at the Detroit Auto Show, it's the current chassis.
And it's not the first time Ford's done that either.
And it's also the current engine, basically. So they'll tell you that the sheet metal's different, and that there's nothing, but basically it's the same engine architecture and the same chassis. And so a lot of the journalists were like, "Yeah, I think that's a refresh, dudes."
Mm-hmm.
But the second more interesting controversy that Ford kicked up was that they called it the longest running American sports car. Now, as you know, there's another car that might have been introduced before 64 and a half.
Yeah, it would be the Corvette.
Exactly.
Yeah, the Corvette was
in the 50s.
53,
exactly.
Was the first one.
Exactly. So Ford had rested that argument on a technicality, because there was like one model year where they didn't have a new model year. They were still selling like the previous model year, but they didn't like call. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think it was going from the C3 to C4 or something like that. There was a gap.
There's a gap where there's not a model year for that, but they were still selling it. So everybody was like, "Hey, hold your horses! Come on, guys! The Corvette was around long before the Mustang."
Ford is Okay, I'm not going to go into what I think about the new generation Honestly, until I drive it.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. So let's talk about this one, the Mustang 2.
Right.
People, I think rightfully dislike this car because basically they took what became a muscle car, right, and turned it into an economy car. That's what happened.
Well, the platform this one's based on is essentially the same platform that was designed for the Ford Pinto, which has really horrible distinction as being a really lousy vehicle. This one, by the way, they even had the Lima four-cylinder in these, which is notoriously weak. And it went all the way up to a big honking V8. They actually did make some very fast versions of this car.
They made a GT 500 version of this.
Essentially.
Shelby. They made a Shelby version of it. Sorry.
And this was also featured in Charlie's Angels, the original show, which is the only reason why I knew about the car. Because, you know, everybody held their nose up to it. But the point is, and the important point is that this car was one of the biggest sellers for Ford. At the time, they absolutely trounced sales of Mustangs prior and many after. But at the same time, it wasn't considered very sporty, especially with that Lima four-cylinder. That thing was just weak sauce. It was still cramped. It had a larger trunk, which is really like one of the things like, oh, it's got a bigger trunk. But yeah, it was basically an economy car trying to look a little sporty. But this was the base model right here, by the way.
Dare I say that, you know, as much as most people hate this car, it was kind of the right car for the right time, right? We had just gone through the energy crisis.
Yeah, this is in the middle of it right here.
This is right in the middle of it. And you know, GM did no favors by introducing the Chevelle.
Mm.
No, sorry, the Chevette, sorry. By introducing the Chevette, which was, you know, in some ways much worse than this, right? So
that came out a little tiny bit later than this. My parents had one.
Did they
my
have
mom,
a Chevette?
Yeah, my mom had a Chevette, which was, I was embarrassed for myself and my family. But my dad was just like, damn it, we're going to find a way to save some gas. This is like,
yeah, and so the Japanese were here, obviously, with the Civic, and that's coming up on our list as well. You know, at the time, like I say, this was the car that Ford needed to build because of emissions and because of the fuel crisis. And if you're too young for that, basically what happened was that Saudi Arabia decided to cut oil production.
Wow, that sounds like what's happening right now.
I know, history doesn't repeat itself. It rhymes, Nathan. Anyway, then there was gas rationing. I remember my dad had an LTD at the time, which was not exactly a very efficient car.
My dad had
car.
A large Fleetwood Cadillac. And
that was even worse.
We actually would wait in like areas. He would stock some gas stations that, you know, weren't 24/7 like they are now. So we would stock gas stations, and he would find one that had a cheap price. And I would be in the back seat waiting to go to school. And he'd go, I don't know, we're going to get gas. And we'd go get gas, beating out people. And my dad would fill up gas like while smoking, which was awesome. And then we would take off, and my dad's like, okay, we got to make that last for a week. And we're doing this in a Cadillac that got, you know, 8 miles per gallon.
Yeah, and I think the way they rationed it was like odd-numbered plates.
They had that, too.
You know, on odd-numbered days.
And I think if you had a personalized plate, which they even had back then, earlier versions of it, then they would go based on
we were kids,
the last
guys.
Thing.
You know, I was like 10 at the time.
Yeah, I was like 3 or 4 years old, but it went on for a little while, especially in Southern California, which is where I was born and raised. So that was horrible. This car is a result of that, especially with its, you know, lower power and just absolute choked off, you know, tiny carburetor.
And the irony is that all they did was just build cars that were just as bad on fuel, right? But just down, I mean, we just come from this muscle car era where we had these giant big block V8s, right, that suck gas like there's no tomorrow. But the problem with this car is that compared to those cars, it did okay. But by modern standards, it was still horrific.
Oh, it was horrific. And this is also the around the time that catalytic converters hit. This is the first generation. Second generation catalytic converters are far better. These earlier ones still had a lot of problems with, I think, nitrogen. But the second part of this whole thing is that these cars, you know, the little PCB valves that they enforce, you had to have all this stuff in them, and it just completely choked performance, going all the way into the 80s.
You know what's crazy? We sometimes in Colorado, this is why pre-76 cars in Colorado are much more valuable, because pre-76 you don't have to smog the car, but post-76 you do, and the legislation is so crazy in Colorado that you have to actually return the cars to the state at which they were in 1976 or 77, right? So if you want to go get it to pass emissions here, you have to go put all that crap back on it, which most people have taken off because it you know, it's horrendous for fuel economy and it's horrendous for performance. And so then you got to go find that stuff. So people are just like, it's not worth it, especially on a car like that.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing. The Mustang II, by the way, is very collectible, but not as a car itself, for the underpinnings. The underpinnings of the Mustang II are used on more kit cars than almost any other platform other than Volkswagen.
If we talked about the Corvette, let's go to the Corvette.
Jump to the Corvette. So yeah. It's interesting because Jalopnik, their readers, chose the C3 version of the Corvette.
I disagree with that. But
I do. I think the C5, in my mind.
So picture the C3 is the Stingray, right? It's the one that's very voluptuous.
Yeah,
right?
The Coke bottle design. One. Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, the C1 was like, it looks like almost like a British sports car.
Yeah, the
right?
rounded off headlights, yeah. Which later on had quad headlights.
But by the C3, you get that classic, beautiful Coke shape. Actually, my dad almost bought one. He ended up buying a Z instead. Mm. But I remember it sitting in the dealer showroom. It was an Indy pace car edition, which is really cool. So it was like this two-tone gray color.
Right.
And I remember as a kid just like wishing my dad would buy it. But it only, if I remember right, had a big old V8. But once again, same problem, right? You're going through this like horrible time with emissions. I think that thing put out like 180 horsepower.
At one point in time, it did. But that's another platform where they had V8s that had, you know, sub 200 horsepower, in some cases mid 100 horsepower range, all the way up to some absolutely astonishing powertrains that were also in that same car, which is why I don't agree with the C3. I think the C5, which was an unusual car, I never thought it looked very good. That was my biggest issue with it. I thought it just was a terrible looking Corvette out of all the Corvettes that have been out there.
So Case, you know, if you guys watch TFL, you know Case, he just bought a C4.
Yeah,
and the distinction about that one is it actually brought like modern car performance. It had that digital dash, especially if you got it pre-1990.
Yeah.
And the coolest thing is it had those headlights that flipped up backwards, right? So they didn't just flip. They didn't pop up. They spun around at a 180-degree.
Yeah.
And that's really cool. When those things go, whoop, you're like, wow.
When they work right, they're awesome to look at. And the car itself was such a departure from the C3. So I think the C4 was really cool, especially because, once again, just another leap for General Motors. The C5, which essentially replaced it, wasn't all that much different, but at the same time, it looked like it was melted, like a melted crayon.
Yeah, so I think that came around, and once again, guys, don't make fun of me if I get this number wrong, but it was like in the late 80s or 90s, right?
It was in the 90s, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was still a pop-up headlight car.
Maybe
it was
maybe
the
like
last
early 90s.
Yeah.
I could probably Google it.
Yeah, early 90s.
I'll Google it. Why not?
Yeah, well, while he's talking, this is an aesthetics thing. It's not necessarily an engineering thing. You know, with the C4, which is the one that Case has, I mean, there was a point in time where they were able to get Lotus to help them with the design of the engine. On top of Lotus, they also worked with Mercury Marine. So there's some fascinating things that happened with the C4. C5, not so much. There were a couple neat versions of it, and, you know, they were known, and they are known as being very easy to acquire. So for you collectors out there, maybe they're
all right. So the C3 third generation went from 1968 to 1982, and then C4, which is what Case has, went from 84 to 96.
Yeah.
So I was wrong. And then the one that you don't like, the C5, that one went from, let me go here.
Was it
96
to
2004.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's funny because I've been, you know, we did that video series where we bought these 90s convertibles, and there isn't as much of a difference in C4 versus C5 prices as you think.
Which I think part of that has to do with the way the C5 looks. I'm not kidding. I think that the aesthetics of it turns people off, and I've heard from a lot of other like Corvette guys. Now, look, I may be totally wrong. I'm not a Corvette guy really, but a lot of people felt that the C5 was just like a quick placeholder, working up to the C6, which was a completely different beast.
Yeah, I remember we had the C6 in here. We had the Grand Sport.
I loved that car.
Yeah, it had those four exhaust pipes coming out the back.
But it was just such a better car in terms of interior build and overall design.
And then the C7 was another, huge step above that.
Huge step. Yeah. So we've been talking about, you know, expensive vehicles or for you know, performance ones. Let's move to something that is a mom and dad car, but extremely popular.
Okay.
And the bestseller for this particular automaker, and that's the Nissan Pathfinder.
Oh, yeah. So so you've owned that car, actually.
I've owned one of them.
And we've owned a Pathfinder, too.
Yes, we have.
We own the first gen.
And I had a third gen.
Yeah.
And the one that they're talking about is a fourth gen, which goes from 2013 to 2020. And I completely agree with the Jalopnik guys who came up with this one, because that is essentially a station wagon.
So, yeah. So here's the thing about Pathfinder. The first one was body on frame. It was a truck.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second one, they went to unibody.
It was unibody, but it was still kind of a truck. It had a solid rear axle, and it was capable.
Third one, body on frame.
Like
truck.
I had, yes.
Fourth one, Mallfinder.
Yeah, the Mallfinder. And, you know, I really wanted to give it I kept thinking, maybe they know something I don't. So Roman and I actually went. It was in Napa, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
To the event for this vehicle. And this is when they shoved a CVT into it. And a CVT dragging around that much weight was a hell of a thing.
I remember going up and down these hills in Napa, right, which were basically like where you would have vineyards.
Yeah, of course.
And I'm thinking to myself, you know, a front-wheel drive Civic, and we'll get to that, could do this. And there we are, you know, in off-road mode in a CVT Pathfinder.
It was very unhappy. And Nissan tried for a while to fix it, and they really didn't, until just recently when they came out with the all-new Pathfinder, mostly new, but it has an all-new powertrain.
A real transmission.
That 9-speed transmission makes such a difference. So... and it wasn't just that. I also felt that the Pathfinder, which used to look butch and macho and capable, suddenly was all rounded and looked like wax was dripped on it.
Yeah, they went from like square to round to square to round. You know what I mean?
And every time, really round.
Yeah, every time you go to like masculine to feminine, if you go and make something more masculine, for some reason, it does better in the marketplace, right? Mm-hmm. Both men and women seem to appreciate more masculine cars. As opposed to when you go and make it more feminine. That doesn't seem to gender as much love, at least when it comes to who buys them and how much they sell.
The other part of it is that even as much as we don't like it, and the audience members of Jalopnik didn't like it, they sold the hell out of them. Nissan Pathfinder sales initially jumped significantly when they came out with it. Why? Because it was suddenly a family vehicle. It wasn't an off-roader anymore. And because of that, they could just basically make a very large cabin with a front-wheel drive platform. And essentially, as an afterthought, they kind of threw in rear drive on it to make it all-wheel drive.
So let's play a game, okay? Let's see if we can do this just off the top of our head. So I'm going to start this, okay? Think of a masculine car that sells incredibly well, right? And then we'll try to do the opposite for a feminine car, and then we'll try to find one that's kind of both masculine and feminine that sells really well.
You know, my wife's going to kill me for this broadcast if she listens to it. Okay.
I'm not trying to be like, I know we're living in weird times, but just go with me on this, because there are masculine criteria, right, that are kind of like built into some vehicles. And I would say a very masculine car would be like a Jeep Wrangler.
I was going to say Wrangler would be my choice.
Yeah, very square jaw, mm-hmm. You know, kind of, you know, it doesn't... It doesn't elicit like you. It's not a car you would stick a lot of flowers on.
Okay,
right? It just would be weird.
All right. And are we talking about current cars being built or ones that have been built?
You pick
too?
Anyway. So how about a feminine car that's
Volkswagen Eos?
An Eos, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely the most feminine car ever made.
Really, the convertible,
mm-hmm.
The little hardtop convertible.
Yeah, I know you liked it, but I hate it. It's the most feminine car ever made. And the reason why I would say that is because there's something about it that. A man can't look like a badass in that. And that's kind of my point. But, you know, anybody else would look fantastic in it.
All right, how about I'm going to be politically correct. I'm going to say a gender-neutral car, one that's kind of doesn't go either way.
Okay. Anything that Mercedes-Benz builds other than the G-Wagon.
You think?
Yeah.
You think they're very kind of...
I think they're general neutral. And actually, most German vehicles I would put in that same thing because it's just, to me, that's what they feel like. If I look at something like, Ford Mustang, obviously they're trying to make it into a manly car. Same with
especially
most sports.
One.
Yeah.
The new one got really angry.
Chiseled, angry look. And I think the angry thing, and Ralph Giels, who...
Giels.
I always say Giels and it's Giels. I know.
Sorry,
I'm
Ralph.
Sorry. Ralph, I'm sorry. But
he's Canadian.
Well, he's also got a Haitian background. Yeah, he's an interesting, amazing
designer. Interesting guy, yeah.
But he likes to use the very heavy-handed, as he would even say, his words, a masculine theme to most of the vehicles he designs. And if you look at his history, yes, those vehicles look like they want to punch you in the face. And that kind of, to me, indicates, you know, the double Y chromosome mentality of that type of design.
So I'll give you one that went from very masculine to very feminine, or somewhat feminine. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by masculine, I mean like it was like chiseled and square and to very rounded. And that's the Corvette. I mean, not the Corvette, the Viper.
Okay, and it's actually on the list.
And it didn't sell. So let's talk about the Viper.
Okay, so what they say is the ZB1 Viper, which is technically the second generation Viper, is the one they're saying is the least popular. Even though it performed better, essentially, than the first gen, they say it's the second gen. I think Roman's saying the third gen is
I'm thinking it's the third gen, right, the one that went, and I'll tell you why. And it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with masculine or feminine. It has to do with the fact that I think they tried to build like a Ferrari competitor. Mm-hmm. So to me, the Viper was like the Harley of cars, right? It was raw and it was unrefined and it didn't have any of the typical driver aids, mm-hmm. you know, safety aids, right? I mean, in the first generation, there was no AB. I don't think there was any ABS. I could be wrong.
No, there was.
Was it?
Yeah.
Maybe that was mandated, but maybe no stability control.
I think even an airbag was an issue at the for the first gen.
But anyway, it you know, it was the kind of car that. You know, you had to drive and you had to know how to drive fast and quickly because you could get in over your head very quickly. And by, like I say, the third generation, it became more of a Lamborghini Ferrari competitor. And it lost that kind of Harley edge, that kind of like, outlaw. Let's call it outlaw edge to it that the first two generations had. Would you agree with that, or am I
totally disagree. You know,
okay,
you and I are very different on the Viper. I know you had horrible driving impressions of especially the third gen. I adore every Viper made, and you know they're not play school cars. And one of the reasons why I think you don't see too many of them at SCCA events, driven by people who don't necessarily know how to drive, is because they do swap ends. If you don't know what you're doing, there's so much torque running through that car, and they're not as big as I think you think they are. They look really big when you see their picture. They're just small.
They are small.
And
for big guys, they're small.
They're not as forgiving as Corvettes. And that's one of the reasons why I think an average driver or even a slightly above average driver can hustle around a Corvette, equal year Corvette, over a Viper. But on the other end,
all right, so the first
proper driver can absolutely hammer a Corvette when they're, and Paul, I bet you would attest to this, when you go around a track with a proper driver.
So the first generation, I just Googled it, went from 91 to 95.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's look at the second generation. That went from 96 to 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third generation went from 2003 to 2006. And then the fourth generation, that's
the
one
That's the one you really don't like.
Don't like. I'm sorry, it wasn't the third. That went from 2008 to 2010. And the fifth generation, which is the one I don't like.
So, oh, it's the fifth?
Yeah, there's five generations of these cars.
Yeah, but they're – okay, so they're being
– 2013 to 2017. That's the one that I'm not a big fan of.
Okay. I'm going to say personally that I felt that there were really three real generations of it. They're kind of cutting between lines. But regardless, the one that you're talking about was the last version of the Viper built. That's the one that you're referring to.
Yes.
That's the one that you drove in the rain.
Yes.
And you just didn't really think much of it. I get that. Also, you didn't like sitting in the cockpit either.
Also, I didn't like the fact that it didn't come with an automatic because I love the vehicle and I want it to survive. And I thought to myself, this has, you know, I mean, the rub against the Viper is that it was originally developed, the powertrain from a truck, right? It's a V10.
Essentially. Yeah. Well, I mean, the similar one.
Right, yeah. So there's a video I did with actually the engineer talking about that. And so, you know, there's arguments on both sides of that. But anyway, you did have this very heavy clutch, and I love the fact that it's manual. Don't get me wrong. But the problem was the guys who were buying this were like probably in their 70s, right? Because they're the ones who can afford it, and they're not going to deal with a heavy-footed manual. And I talked to Ralph about it, and I said, Ralph, you know, if you want this thing to succeed, I think you're going to need to do an automatic. And he was like, you know, we're lucky. Because that was right when it was the company. It was actually Chrysler was purchased by Stellantis, mm-hmm. and so they were like a gnat's breath away from selling the Viper.
No, you mean that's when they were bought by Fiat, not Stellantis. This is before.
Oh, it was the Fiat? Yeah, yeah. Fiat and then Stellantis. So yeah, Fiat bought them, and it was like a gnat's breath away from actually being sold, I think, to the to an investment group at the time. And
they were temporarily. They were a part of a Cibris.
No, but Cibris was
going to peel them off. Yeah, and that was even worse.
Worse, yeah.
And then Fiat came along. And it was like some
bureaucratic, the contract was signed at the wrong time, and so it stayed with Fiat and then eventually Stellantis.
Right.
But, he said basically that they were just lucky enough to develop it, given the budget, and that an automatic would have just been too much money. But I think it was what killed the Viper, because the people who would buy those things probably wanted an automatic, not a manual.
And I would flog that horse. Yeah, I know. I would agree. An automatic probably would have saved it at least for another year or so. But the point is that, you're wrong, and that's okay about the Viper. But they, according to the readers, they say the ZB1 version, 2003, that's the one that they dislike. Let's move on to one of the most popular vehicles in the country that's not a pickup truck.
Okay.
And that's the Honda Civic.
Yeah, and we actually had first-hand experience with this one. We were there when they unveiled it, and all the journalists stood around with their mouths agape, thinking to themselves, what the hell have they done?
Well, we saw what was a refresh. This is actually the seventh generation, which goes from 2000 to 2004, essentially 2005. And that's the seventh generation is the most boring-looking Civic out there. And they went from building a vehicle that gave you kind of a little bit of an experience with a little tiny bit of fun to an appliance, essentially. So I do agree with Jalopnik on this choice. The seventh generation had pretty soft styling, and the one that replaced it, the eighth generation, was like much more futuristic. Maybe it was a little overdone, but I thought it was a much better looking vehicle, and perhaps the one that had a little bit more passion baked into it. I always felt that Civics before then, before the seventh, were kind of good looking, especially the SI. So this is a personal thing. This is what I think. Roman's actually looking it up on his phone right now, but I do agree with him on that. And I am, once again, also curious about your perspective. The very last version of the Civic was one of the first auto events I went to as a journalist. So there's that. I think I was like around 2003 or so. Okay, should we move on, Roman?
No, because you got it wrong, dude, and Jalopnik got it wrong. It was the ninth generation. I think that was the bad one. Not the seventh.
So you tell me why you think the ninth one. I know exactly which one the ninth one is.
It was 2011.
That's right? The one where we went and we actually saw them. Oh, man. I think it was.
And then within a year, Honda actually had to go and redevelop it with a new exterior and a new interior.
People
hated it so much that it took them a year to actually refresh it.
I didn't hate it as much as everybody else did, though. And this is why I'm agreeing with the seventh generation as opposed to that one. One of the biggest problems was they were like midway with everything, and it just didn't look like or act like.
Everybody was like, this is horrible. It was bland, and it was boring, and it was like.
The infotainment system didn't work right. There was like a lot of problems.
Interior was like way below market. And so within a year, they actually had to refresh both the interior and the exterior.
Which they've never done before. Usually it's like a four-year thing. And what happened was we went to, I think it was the LA Auto Show, where the CEO came out, and he was extremely defensive about the car and why. We decided to do this on our own. It has nothing to do with your perspective. It's what we decided. I was like, I've never seen a Honda person acting so defensive ever or since, for that matter.
CEO of America, not...
He was Honda America for sure. Yeah, the dude was really like, you know, he's toose about it. And it was, all of us, even the journalists are kind of looking at each other like, dude.
But anyway, usually, so the way that usual car life cycles work is, in general, not always, like obviously cars like the Viper and the Corvette are an exception. Mm-hmm. And trucks are also different. But most cars have a four-year life cycle.
The ones that are on the value base, yeah.
And then halfway through, they refresh them. So they come out, then they build them for 2 years, then they do a mild refresh. Basically, they jazz up the taillights.
Maybe a little bit different headlights. They'll replace them with LEDs. Sometimes they'll like put in a bigger infotainment screen. Maybe they'll change the speaker arrangement around. They'll do some minor things just enough to say, okay, this car has been refreshed, and let's talk about it.
And then in another 2 years, there's the next generation. This one, within a year, they were like, oh, boy, we got to change this up.
Yeah. There's something that happened inside that we'll never know at Honda that really made that happen. But I'm going back to the seventh generation. It's still one of my least favorites out of all of them. It just took all the passion out of the Civic. It was such a fun car. Now, speaking of passion, can we move on to the next one on this list? We're kind of bouncing around here.
Sure.
This is not in any particular order, by the way. And that is the current BMW 3 Series.
Ooh, they picked the current one, huh?
A current one. There's a couple current ones in here, actually. There's a sub one as well, which as a bonus. The current BMW 3 Series, mechanically, I can't really fault it very much, but I know where they're going with this, and I'm sure you guys do too, and that's the front-end design, with all BMWs for that matter. The whole beaver teeth thing, which I'm sure many people have talked about ad nauseum, but in this case, I would say that the whole car, BMWs became so heavy, so overwrought, and in many cases unreliable. And on top of that, their styling, which used to be really cutting-edge European, with a couple exceptions. I wasn't a big fan of what Bangle did with some of the BMW products out there. But anyway, this particular one, according to the readers at Jalopnik, is least favorite, and that's the modern one.
So my favorite would be the E30 or the E36.
Now, the E30 is my favorite.
Yeah, E30 runs from 1982, and then it was followed by the E36, which came out in 1990. So we actually had an E30 convertible, if you remember, for a while, and that's the iconic one with the round headlights and the kind of clamshell hood, right? That opens up.
A great design. Yeah, it's very European.
Yeah, second generation. It was a perfect size. It had the perfect kind of look to it, the perfect, it was a just right car. Then they built upon that with the E36. And over time, the BMW 3 Series became like Car and Driver's perennial top 10 pick. And then the Model 3 came out and the world changed and BMW all of a sudden found that their bestseller no longer was relevant. And so I kind of feel like what they're doing now is they're really struggling to find relevance for it because, look, the BMW 3 Series was always this compromise between family sedan and performance car and understated performance, right? That's what BMWs were all about. They were about understated performance. They were sleepers, but they were incredibly well-built, at least the early ones, well, relatively well-built. They handled incredibly well, and they drove incredibly well. The straight six power plant was the smoothest ever built. It had everything going for it. And then all of a sudden, overnight, Tesla came and changed the world. And two things happened. Not only did electrification happen, but also sedans went out of vogue. So now we're in a moment of time where BMW is, I think, really struggling to find where it fits and what the brand values are. And that's why I think you're seeing these like giant beaver teeth on the front of it. I think you're seeing, BMW trying to find its way in a world that has become much more electrified and much different from the world that that car was brought into.
Well, the good news for BMW is that they are moving to all electrification, which is sort of mandated, so they have to anyway. The Germans are really on top of that. And we did drive a 5 Series version of the BMW with an electric powertrain, and it was out of this world excellent. It was a great car. I felt that the front-end styling was really the only thing that held it back from being next to damn perfect. It was so good.
I kind of feel like they're throwing things up against the wall to see what'll stick, right? They've got hybrid cars. There's a purely electrified BMW 3 Series, right? There's one that's a hybrid. They're just trying to figure out what is the best solution for their customers. And it's ironic because they were one of the first car companies with the i8 and the i3. Right?
They were
way ahead of the curve, and somehow they went from being ahead of the curve to like being behind the curve. I'm still kind of confused by how that all came to be.
I think they became gun shy because the i3 did not sell well, and they were expecting it to sell much better. And it's a great car. Andre bought one that we used to have at TFL. Really, really good
car. Yeah,
remarkable engineer.
He had the range extender, so he had both the electric and the little tiny Kymco 600cc engine in it. And the i8 was just kind of this weird. We tried to buy one at one point. I just think it's a beautiful car, but it's kind of like, I don't know if it was. Sometimes, you know, with cars, they're either too early or too late, and that one may have missed the wave completely.
I think their timing was off. There are a lot of car companies that are way ahead of the curve. They miss the time, and then they pull their car back, and then everybody remarks, just like us, hey, they were ahead of their time. Let's move on to, we're almost done with this list, but I don't want to, how do I put it? I don't want to jump on Dodge too much, but there are a couple Dodges coming up. Let's go on the Dodge Durango.
All right, let's talk about the Durango.
The second generation, which was hideous.
Okay.
They went from a pretty good-looking truck, which was based on, you know, the Dakota, which at the time was the rounded body Dakota, which I still think is one of the best-looking small trucks out there. And they built this Durango, and it blew everybody away because it held seven people. And up to seven people, and it was small enough to put in your garage. You could get one with a V8. In fact, really, I don't think they ever had a four-cylinder. I think it was V6 and V8. They even had a sporty version of it. They never had a super off-roady version of it, and part of the reason why was because they were connected with Jeep, and Jeep had, at the time, the Commander.
let me put the ears on this. First generation came out in 1997, and that was a truck based. Obviously, that was the one that people remember fondly.
Yeah, 97, I think, is where the Dodge Durango second gen popped in.
No, first gen was 97. Second gen, I'll tell you, that's the one that nobody likes. Oh, just lost it there. Second gen was, come on, give me second gen. 1997 was first gen, according to Wiki.
Okay.
Second generation was 2004, so that was that.
Why do I have 97 written here? I guess
that was the second generation right there.
Yep, that's the one.
Yeah, and then the first generation was the one.
So what they did is they
looked like a semi truck.
Yeah, they squared off everything and they made it bulbous, and it didn't have balance, and it just looked terrible. It didn't inspire any confidence from any buyers. Like, oh wow, this looks like it's a cool truck that's fun to drive off road. No. And it didn't look like a cool truck at all. It looked like a minivan with an unusual front end.
It looks like a startled cat.
Yeah, but I mean, just look how big the passenger
section
is.
I know. It's all
squared off.
It's all weird, yeah.
And what they did was they based it loosely on a concept vehicle that they introduced.
And then it got this facelift.
Which looks even worse. So the second generation.
That came in 2007.
Dodge Durango was dreadful. The third generation, which we still have essentially,
and they got worse. Then they made that out of it. Aspen.
That's the Aspen. The Aspen was, but they also made a hybrid version of the Aspen too. By the way, they had.
And then it got good
like 1 year
in 2011 with the third.
That's
gen.
It, 2011 with it, and that was an all new vehicle on an all new platform, much better.
All right, so let me ask you this, Nathan.
Yeah,
you know that they're brought back the Hellcat powered.
Yes, temporarily they brought back the SRT Hellcat.
Right, so they sold 2,000 originally, which I got to drive.
Yeah.
Do you lust after one of those?
Yes.
I think it's a good time to
buy one. I would buy one of those over the Cadillac. I would buy it over the Cadillac.
Would you really?
I would totally buy it over the
CTS-V
Cadillac.
That we had, the V Escalade that we had at the office, you would buy that. You would not. Well, first of all, that's $150,000, and the Durango Hellcat
is
going to be like $90,000.
Yeah.
Right?
Or 80 or 90, yeah.
Yeah.
By the time it
gets to dealers, it's going to be 90.
I think it'll drive circles around the Cadillac on any course, and then it has more power. It has over 700 horsepower.
Yeah, 707, right, if it's the traditional.
Yes, everything about it
is. It might be 702, if I remember right. It might be a little bit less.
I go with the vehicle I identify with more than the vehicle I want to be identified by.
If I only had an instrument where we could find this exact number.
If we only had something we could do
that way.
And I can't use this computer because we've got to keep this thing up on screen. Yeah, the Dodge Durango, the second gen, just never had anything redeeming about it as far as I'm concerned. I just didn't like the looks of it. Yes, it was bigger on the inside, but everything about the platform it was based on just seemed crappy.
710, it went the other way. Wow.
Oh, they put out even more horsepower now. Okay.
710,
and so now the third generation, which is good, all the way through, I mean, some people might say that they're a little bit on the thirsty side, perhaps, if you get the V6 compared to other vehicles they compete against. And perhaps the interior is a little tight in the third row. I would agree with that, too. But as Roman mentioned, They have a version that puts out 710 horsepower with a supercharged engine going to all four wheels. It is far less expensive than the Cadillac. And personally speaking, after driving one on a track and driving them all over Colorado and Los Angeles, I would totally get one.
All right.
So put a fork in that.
So let's talk about the Mazda Miata, which you have on your list. Which one
yes.
are they saying is the third generation?
They're saying the NC, the 2006. That was the one where they went to much more of a bulbous design. I don't really agree with them necessarily.
NCQs came from the 2003 Mazda Ibuki concept car, according to Wiki. Mm-hmm. It was introduced in 2005 and was in production until 2015.
Mm-hmm.
So then the ND came along. That was from 2014 to 2019. And before the NC was the MB. So it's easy. It just goes alphabetical, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then that one from 98. Until whenever the NC came along. I actually don't like the second generation.
That's the one I don't like either.
Right.
I just don't look
the
looking
MB.
At it. Yeah.
I don't mind the NC. Wasn't the NC the biggest of them, if I remember right? It had the most room?
Well, at the time it was it was bigger than the prior ones. I'm not sure if it's bigger than the other ones that are in existence now, but
it introduced a power retractable hardtop. That's not good.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with him. The funny thing about Miatas is that I always felt like the first gen was my favorite. I know that I can't fit comfortably.
The NA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The with the pop-up headlights and the whole there was such a simple, basic car, and I really enjoyed driving them. But the most recent one, we had the one with the retractable hardtop.
Yes.
It's a fantastic car. It's so freaking well made. And if you go back in time, every single version of the Miata is a driver's car.
It is.
Every single version is.
I agree.
They never lost that sauce. Well, I thought that they would ruin it.
There is that saying, Miata's the answer.
I would say yes.
I would say no, because I don't fit in any of the freaking Miatas.
Well, as long as the top's down, you're fine.
No, I look right into the top of the A-pillar.
Okay. Well,
I have to drive it like my mom with my head scrunched down so I can actually see through it, and that's with the top up.
I do wish they would allow for the seat to have a little bit more rake so you could go back.
I know, and Dave Coleman, you know, who was one of the engineers at
Mazda.
He's
an amazing guy.
He was like, I could make anybody fit in the Mazda Miata. I'm like, okay, make me fit. And no, he couldn't make me fit. The choice you end up with is either scrunching down or driving it like Andre with your knees at that point in a Miata in your chin. Because you push the seat forward and you recline it, right?
So what Andre does when he drives.
Yeah, yeah, he drives like a pimp.
Yeah.
And then you've got your knees up in the air. So I love the Miata. It is such a forbidden fruit for me, Nathan. I can't tell you how much I would love to own one of those. I just do not fit. And I've been so close to like buying an old one because they're affordable, dude. You could buy a nice NA probably for $10,000.
Yeah, I bet you
or
could.
Less.
Or less, well, but like a well taken care of one.
And an NC probably like $15,000 because they're just a lot of them. They're like tax, right? They're
yeah,
everywhere.
Well, they're the best selling convertibles yes. made right now. I would say that we probably have one generation left before they either scrap them or they make them electric. That's my guess. Because Mazda, like everybody else, is going to have to go electric. So whatever's coming out soon, and I hear rumors that they are going to build one more. I even heard rumor that it might do a rotary.
This is like, you know how they have like first world problem. This is a tall person problem, right? In 99% of life, it's good to be tall, right? But there are two times in life where it sucks being tall. One is in an airplane, and two is in a Mazda MX-5 Miata.
Yeah, especially if it's a hard top convertible, then you're really screwed. Okay, let's move on. We have two more cars left.
Okay,
and I think I want to save the Porsche for last.
Sure.
Because I think you and I very much agree on it. So this other car is the fifth generation Dodge Charger. Now, for those of you who don't remember this car, and I don't blame you, this was the front wheel drive one. It was built between, it was the early 80s to the mid 80s, 82 to 87, I believe, and had a Shelby version, but it was front wheel drive, and it was like an extended length Plymouth
Horizon. So which generation is it?
Fifth.
Okay, so first went from 96 to 97. Second went from, this is weird, first generation 1966 to 1967.
Yeah.
Sorry. Second went from 68 to 70. Third went from 71 to 74.
Third was ugly as hell, too. But
fourth went from 75 to 78. And you're saying the fifth generation from 82 to 87. Oh, my God. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that car.
All squared off. And
yeah. I actually drove that car. You know where we drove it? Before it broke.
Yes.
We were at the Dodge house.
That's right.
It was the Dodge brothers' house.
So we went on the 100th anniversary of Dodge over to their actual house where they had all these museum pieces.
Yeah, and this thing took a dump.
Yeah, and that was the one out of all the cars. There were two cars that broke down.
Because it was a Shelby.
Yeah, it was the Shelby. Shelby.
Yeah.
I believe that was one of the ones where someone jumped into it and just died. And they never put out more than like 145 horsepower, 150 horsepower at the most. And at the time, they just really didn't fit the image of what a Charger was. Now, there were some other interesting cars at the time that it competed against. And also, this thing did turn into the Plymouth Laser later on, or maybe been around that time. And the Plymouth Laser, I thought, looked a little bit cooler, a little bit more 80s. But yeah, it really wasn't much of a replacement for the Challenger. Or for the Charger, I mean. So yeah, it was blah. Not so great.
But you know, when we were kids, dude, it was like that and the GLH. Remember the GLH?
Which was an Omni. It was like hell. Yeah. I actually thought that was kind of a cool car by comparison.
But all those cars, because we were living like past, you know, at least me, I'm older than you are. I went to high school, you know, in the 80s, right? And we were living with the catastrophic remnants of cars from the 70s.
Right.
And so we loved like all the 60s cars, right? Because they had gotten affordable. So all those muscle cars were actually pretty gettable in the 80s.
Right. And you're talking early 80s. I was at the end of the 80s.
But the new cars that were coming out were horrendous.
Yeah. Some of them were horrible.
Yeah.
Well,
until the Fox Betty Mustang. That was like the first like American car where you were like, oh, wow, that's pretty badass.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of people who would agree with you on that. The 80s were a very unusual time for kids in high school looking up to cars because in the early 80s, a lot of people were looking back at the 60s. My sister had a 67 or 68. It was a 68 Camaro that my dad got her because he hated us. So he got it for her because his other kids didn't matter. But sorry, but it was really cool. It was like this pumpkin orange.
Is your sister listening to this?
No, she doesn't listen to anything I do. So it was a really cool car, and when I finally had a chance to drive, I did buy a 65 Mustang, but I had it with a six-cylinder engine. My sister had a big V8 in hers, so whole different world. Okay, so let's go on to our number one, because I think our number one is something that you and I very much agree on and very much disagree with Jalopnik's choice, Jalopnik's viewer's choice.
They picked the 911 964.
That's right.
Which came around in 89 and was around until 93.
So it was essentially an early 90s car.
The last of the air-cooled.
Yeah, it was the last of the air-cooled and only lasted 4 years in the market. Very, very short run time on it. I thought this car was incredible. I thought I loved looking at it. It was the last air-cooled, you know, Porsche in that era, and I was just like, for me, it was just so cool and different.
We had an 87 911, and that's a Carrera 3.2 because it had a 3.2 liter mm-hmm. engine. And ours is the G, which stands for the G50, which is the transmission, because in 87 they went to a G50 transmission. So that was the last generation before the 964, where they actually started numbering them. So that's where the numbering came from. But I think most Porsche files would agree that the next generation after the
996
was the one because that's the first water-cooled one. And that's when Porsche went to distinctly kind of down market in their interiors. It had those fried egg headlights.
I couldn't stand the exterior
that people hated.
Yeah.
And we actually had one of those too. We had a C2.
That was the first Porsche I think TFL bought.
Yeah, 996 C2. And the problem with that one was it had like 100,000 miles and all the switches were already like worn off.
The throw-out bearing I think was an issue.
That one had the IMS.
That was it.
The IMS bearing would break and then it would basically detonate the entire engine. It was so bad that the block would crack. We saw one when we were replacing our IMS. They showed us what happened when that went away and it would crack the entire block.
We got lucky. Ours actually
had a replaced one.
We did have to replace that component. We've had.
We replaced the replaced one.
Yeah, we replaced the one that was replaced. Yeah, second. And I think TFL's had about half a dozen Porsches since, roughly. I know we had two Boxsters.
Yeah, right now we have a 944 Turbo.
And the 944.
Yeah.
Probably my favorite of all the Porsches we've had is the 944 we currently have. But Roman and I both agreed that the 964, I think, was a work of art. I don't care what the other guys say. It was an incredible car to drive. I did drive one. A relative of mine had one and allowed me to have a little bit of fun. The 996 is just kind of visually a little bit of a train wreck for some people.
Yeah, so it also became kind of like the Everyman 911, right? So they built a lot of them, and now they still, even now, they still sell for like, you know, you could probably get yourself into a high mileage one for around $20,000. The turbos are worth more, but the regular Carrera 2 996s are they're just not going up in price. People still don't like them.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they are Porsches. They are 911s. They drive it like 911s, but they've got issues.
I agree.
So, yeah.
Okay, so that essentially is our list. There is a bonus, Roman. I wanted to give it to you.
Yeah, what's your bonus?
This is, once again, according to Jalopnik, and I don't agree with them, but it's not a horrible choice. They say the current Subaru WRX, they do not like its styling at all.
So what's the year that they built it that had the underpowered engine? There was like 1 year.
So
was that like 2014? There was 1 year where it was so bad that they had to immediately replace it.
I think that was all the way back in 2009, 2010.
Was it back that far?
That's what. Well, that was when they didn't do the fender flares, and they had – it just basically was an Impreza-based vehicle with a WRX engine in it. And
there was 1 year that's like a horrible one.
They replaced that. They got rid of it very quickly. Well, that's what I'm saying, 2009, 2010. They got rid of it real quickly, and they came out with the flared fenders and a much better overall WRX because it had a wider stance and it handled better and it was just a better vehicle altogether. So, and also it was the Impreza-based WRX as opposed to ones that were on the new modular platform, which came later. So anyway, the one that they say is essentially the 2022 or 2021.
If I remember right, that 1 year had like a single tailpipe. That was the one that was.
I believe it was 2009, 2010. That's
it could be right. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's also wagon. Do you know that? There's also wagon. Do you remember that?
Yeah, actually I do. Yeah. It was sedan and wagon.
And then there's a Saab version of it.
Yeah,
the 9.2.
Yeah, the Saab 9.2. Actually, that really should be the caveat on this. So if you look up the Saab 9.2, you'll essentially find the same vehicle, except for a nicer interior. That was the one thing about the 9.2 is that it had a much nicer looking interior. But otherwise, it was basically a WRX and not one of their better ones.
No.
And, you know, guys, if you have a contrary position, by all means, please list it below. I actually feel like if you're going to go Subaru in terms of the vehicles that just perhaps don't stir your milk or whatever, I would say that the Tribeca was a huge mistake in terms of design, but that's just me. And they don't build it anymore, so I guess that doesn't really matter.
Yeah, that was their attempt at a family hauler, and it didn't work.
Yeah, the newer one is a much better vehicle in every measurable way. It's just boring, but whatever. Anyway, so we want to hear what your perspective is on what you would choose in terms of the most popular cars that had a really bad version. And I know there are other ones out there. We only covered a small amount of them. So by all means, let us know below.
Yeah, and then we promised them one last thing before we wrap this up, Nathan.
Oh, yeah.
And that is best new car for winter, now that winter's coming. And I've been thinking a lot about that. And so let's separate it into two different worlds, internal combustion and electric, because really we've got now two different worlds of cars.
We have two. And we're going to try to stick with cars and not trucks,
so,
right?
Let's try it with cars. I thought, let's start with the electric, right?
All right.
I don't think there are any great choices for winter electric cars, because what happens with battery range is it goes down by like 25% in the winter.
It depends on the vehicle, but it can go up to 25%. That's a pretty good measure. I would disagree. I think your son has recently looked at a vehicle that's somewhat affordable. And I've driven him in the snow before a little bit, and that is the Volkswagen ID.4. It's got some decent ground clearance. The all-wheel drive system works quite well. I do not like the infotainment system or any of the interior IP setup, but it drove fine in the snow.
Yeah, but it's not like you. I wouldn't
call it a snow car.
If I had to go into a blizzard, it would not be the keys I would grab. That's what I'm thinking about. Like Colorado winter car. I'm not talking about Illinois where it might snow once or twice a year. Or I'm talking about like I'm going to go skiing and I want a winter car that's going to get me to the lodge in a snowstorm. And that would not be the keys. I mean, the one I would grab, and it's a truck, unfortunately, is either the H2 or the Rivian.
Right. Really? You wouldn't do the Ford Lightning?
No, because the tires on that thing are not that great. The ones that come, at least the one that were on ours, were more designed for low rolling resistance than they were for. Remember, we had a swap out to ATs to actually get any traction.
Yeah. And
so the Rivian comes with KO2s, I think. And the Hummer comes with Goodyear Destinations.
No, the Hummer came with,
Goodyear Destinations. Yeah. Which they're the same tires that were on the TRX, and the TRX is unstoppable.
Oh, in anything.
No, sorry, same tires that are on the Bronco.
The TRX came with the Goodyear.
Yeah. Anyway, unstoppable. So maybe you can go for the R1S. You know, the
haven't driven it, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah, Andre only drove
it. I'm only basing what I really know, as opposed to what I'm guessing.
The problem with that car is it's too expensive. I mean, any car that costs, like, I don't even consider a car that costs, any of those cars and trucks cost $90,000. Mm-hmm. So that's not something that most people have access to. So you're not going to have a chance to grab the keys to your Hummer or your Rivian because they're unobtainium, or your Lightning. So the cars that are attainable that are electric, Bolt, front-wheel drive, might be okay in the snow.
Tommy, I mean, anything with front-wheel drive is
with snow tires. Tommy has he bought it from the company. He's got the Mini SE, which is the electric Mini, and we put those Cross Climates on there. Thank you to Michelin, right? Cross Climate Michelin.
I honestly don't know who the tires are you talking about. But
anyway, Cross Climates might be Firestone, right?
I can't Michelin. Help you there. Sorry.
What does Michelin own? They own
Michelin
owns BFGs.
Yeah.
So they might be. Anyway, I apologize. Oh, I'll Google it here. You talk. I'll Google.
Okay.
It.
So while he's doing that,
I want to get that right.
You know, when you're talking about affordable electric vehicles, first of all, there aren't a lot of them, and then secondly, going to affordable all-wheel drive.
They're Michelin. I got it right.
Okay, Michelin.
Yeah. So those are great. They're all year. They're all year winter rated, snow rated tires. But the Mini has 114 miles of EPA range, and in the winter it's more like 90 miles of real world range. And so even if you've got good traction, you're still not going to want.
Yeah, I've got got Coopers on my daughter's little.
So Leaf and front wheel drive.
It's front wheel drive. It's just a front wheel drive car in snow. So Ioniq affordable
5, EV6,
right. An affordable all-wheel drive vehicle. There aren't a lot of them.
Electric.
That's electric. There aren't a lot of them out there. Now,
maybe you're right. Maybe it is the ID.
I just think that under the circumstances, and as I said, I've driven it. It did just fine. Actually, it's pretty good on loose soil. Doing hardcore off-roading, forget it. But we're just talking about snow.
We need that Scout. The Volkswagen's building.
Yeah, which I'd love to tell you guys about, but we're not going to. there's no information available on it.
So if you don't know, Volkswagen is bringing back the Harvester Scout model as a dedicated EV and off-roady vehicle. So that seems like a good one for the snow. It's not around yet. The ID Buzz, I think it's based on the ID
ID4
platform. So it's going to be an
EQB platform, I think it is.
So all-wheel drive once again, and all-wheel drive with no tires.
If we're going to go that direction, then we might as well look at what Mercedes and BMW have and Audi as well. I mean, they all have all-wheel drive vehicles, but they're all very expensive.
Yeah, any of them. Same thing. Like, okay, here's a good one. Okay, here's one that I think you could use. It's got one problem. That's the GLE, Mercedes-Benz GLE. It's a little small crossover. So it's
GLE is gas. Is it
GLB is gas. The GLE is electric.
GLE. Okay, got it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So the GLB is this, like, it's actually a three-row, small, tall crossover.
Oh, you did a video on it.
Yeah, and they took and they stuck an electric power plant into it. Unfortunately, it's only got like 200-some miles of range, but that's better than 114.
I'll take 200 miles.
I'll take 200. So let's say realistically in the winter you're maybe at like 175, 180. I think it's more like 220 when it's, you know, when it's
most
warm.
Americans have less than a 50-mile commute. So you're fine.
So that one might be doable because it's in the 50s versus like – so that's one potential.
And that starts – $53,000 or something like that.
Audi just introduced the Q4 e-tron, right? The problem with that one is it's once again an ID4 chassis.
Essentially, yeah. A lot of it is the same platform.
And it's funny for Audi because it can be had. The intro one is two-wheel drive, rear-wheel drive.
Yeah, so let's go on to vehicles that everybody can buy right now.
Yeah, because there's nothing electric really.
Not really, but there's a lot of gas ones, and there's a hybrid out there.
The Lyric, you can't buy it.
There's a plug-in hybrid that's out there that Tommy recently drove that felt was actually pretty damn impressive.
All right, what's that?
It's the Mitsubishi
PHEV. Yeah.
Tommy drove one, and I watched I write up some of these things, and so I had to watch the video very carefully to listen to Tommy. And
good call.
Really good setup. And they have managed over the years, despite the CVTs, which I do not like, and this is different than a regular CVT, by the way, it's a whole different story here, but the point is that it has a really good all-wheel drive system. one that actually can give you rear drive bias if you want it. And on top of that, it can hold 7 passengers standard and has a much nicer interior than anything that's come before it. Essentially, think of it as a Nissan Rogue with a third row and with a really interesting plug-in hybrid system.
So I got to throw a couple more.
Yeah.
Base Bronco, base Wrangler.
Oh, I'd say the Bronco Sport is an
Bronco Sport.
That's a great little driver.
All unstoppable in the snow. Yeah. And you won't lose any range.
But then almost anything that Jeep builds, most of them are pretty damn good in the snow.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I agree.
One of the things you need to look for in an all-wheel drive vehicle that you're going to be taking in the snow nowadays, they all have a different mode. If it has a snow mode, you're already off to a good start because it'll often start you in second gear, which really does help, and it'll change the inputs going into ABS.
Look, let's be honest. Really, the most important part are the tires, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So you know, a huge caveat in the discussion is any car with snow tires
is way better than one without. That's
than
sure.
one without. Or you know, I would even go as far as to say a front-wheel drive or a rear-wheel drive car with snow tires is better than an all-wheel drive car with all seasons. Much better.
It depends on a lot of things.
It's about stopping.
It is about stopping, and it is about going, and also
about
cornering. But snow tires are even – I know that some of them are rated with snowflakes. That doesn't mean it's a snow tire. An actual dedicated snow tire, snow and ice tire – is far better than not having one. That's for damn sure. And we've had an opportunity to drive in the snow. Now, if you do have a vehicle that has all-wheel drive and you want just one set of tires, all-season tires with the snowflake is a little bit more aggressive in the snow than one without the snowflake. So I would recommend looking that way.
I just put snow tires on my wife's car, mm-hmm. BMW X5 that we've had for a couple of years. And I've been doing that, swapping them twice a year. And we go to discount, and it's about as painless as you can be, right? But I still have to – these are very big, heavy tires.
And you've got to lift them and put them in the car,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I got to drag them down in the basement, 4 of them, right, then drag the other ones back in the basement. And they put them in plastic, but still you get dirty.
Yeah.
And you got to – you know, my wife has all this stuff in the back – sorry, honey – in the back of her car. So I got to, you know, clean out the car, put the tires in, take it to discount, mm-hmm. have somebody pick me up. You know, have somebody take me back, right? They'll do it while you wait, but then you wait for an hour, which is, you know, a good amount of time. And so I kind of like these new cross-climate tires, the all-season tires that are snow-rated. I think that's a really good solution.
It's a very good solution, but there are very few manufacturers that actually build a vehicle with that because they have to have a return on their investment, and by putting these more expensive tires on there, it makes the car more expensive for you. So I do recommend looking at those if you do live in a snowy climate.
Those came out of Canada because Canada, the French part of it, passed legislation like they have in Europe saying that you have to have snow tires or snow-rated tires in the winter. And so before, the manufacturers were very hesitant in America to sell like snow-rated all seasons, or the technology wasn't there because snow tires in the summer will basically melt off them. They'll just melt,
mm-hmm.
right? The compound comes into its own at 44 degrees.
Right. It's built to be very adhesive in cold weather as opposed to regular tires that turn into hockey pucks very hard.
Yeah. Yeah. So what else? So I like the Bronco Sport. I like the Bronco. I like the Wrangler. What else? There's a ton.
A majority of the vehicles Jeep builds.
I think a 4Runner.
Forerunners are great, but they're really heavy. Just they're like a Wrangler in the snow. They remind me of each other. Having something that would be like a...
I like ground clearance, right? Because if it's deep snow, you want ground clearance.
So if you can have around 8 inches or more of ground clearance, almost everything Subaru builds is over 8 inches of ground clearance.
Not that we would know because they don't lend us cars.
No, they really don't.
So I assume it's good.
But we have driven some of the Crosstrek. We have a lot of experience with the older Crosstrek and some of those other ones.
But the CVT, yeah.
But I will say that I've driven them in the snow, and even though they're slow, they move, and they do wonderful in the snow, and they're very safe. Okay, but moving on, there's a lot of other vehicles that are out there that are actually pretty interesting. You know one that actually gets very little fanfare, but I think is fantastic in the snow? The Mini Countryman. Fantastic in the snow, even the plug-in hybrid version.
My mom has one of those, yeah.
It's great in the snow, but it has to have the right snow tires. My wife's Countryman, which is the only one, has Pirellis on there, and they're all season, but they're really not.
That's not great.
But but that all-wheel drive system makes it move, and it's very light. But so, you know, obviously tires are really the way to go, but there are quite a few. God, almost everybody builds an all-wheel drive vehicle that's excellent in the snow, if you think about it. BMW, majority of their small crossovers are quite good in the snow. We've tested almost all of them, right? Mercedes-Benz, same way.
Yeah.
I mean, am I wrong?
No, at some point, you know, it becomes about tires because the technology to make the car go, not necessarily to stop, but to go, is pretty much there, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, the stability control keeps you pointing the way you've got the steering wheel pointing. The ABS hopefully keeps you from sliding. But that doesn't mean that the tires have any grip. And even, you know, with the latest and greatest electronics, if the tires are bad, you're still going to be like a goat on an ice rink.
Right. So it's the first thing that's really important to ascertain is whether or not you have good tires. Now, there are some cars out there that have crap tires on them right out of the manufacturing hold, and that's the worst. So take a look at your tires. If you don't recognize the brand, which you might not, look them up online, look at their ratings, go to a couple sites because sometimes they're biased. But at the end of the day, the first thing you need to do if you are in snow country or are going to be moving to snow country, change your tires.
You know who does snow modes as well? I think Hyundai and Kia do snow modes in all their cars.
They're really good snow modes.
Yeah, if I recall.
And there's a locker. Well, it's kind of a locker where you can get 50-50 split front and rear at low speeds, which can help you in sticky situations in snow.
Yeah.
I've used it. It works.
Yeah. So, whether lockers make a car better or worse in snow is depending on the situation, right? Because if you lock up, like let's say you have a Jeep Wrangler and you've got lockers in the front and the back. If you lock up all four in the snow, it gives you more traction, but it does also create this kind of crabbing when you go around a corner because they're both spinning at the exact same. So you'll have more traction, but you'll have this kind of crabbing, which is actually okay in the snow because you won't tear up your drivetrain, but I'm not sure it makes the vehicle perform better.
No, I would agree it doesn't, actually. You want a limited slip. It would be the best option in going around a corner. But that's a whole different thing. So, and there's other vehicles that do that. So anything with a locker would
get... What does Nissan have that would be good? A Pathfinder, I think the newest
one. The Rogue is actually quite good all around.
Yeah, remember we took the old one up.
Oh, that was the first-gen Rogue. Man, that was years ago. So yeah. Roman and I went to Moab Easter Jeep Safari, which was great, and we took this little first-generation Nissan Rogue, and... That poor thing, it had a CVT, barely enough horsepower to get out of its own way. We actually took it off-road a little bit, too. And we took it back home in the middle of a snowstorm. And it was a hell of a snowstorm. And three things that were a problem, but one thing that was good. It actually tracked just fine. We were on crappy tires, and we went straight up a hill. We saw a cop trying to go up the hill sideways in front of us. Headlights were terrible. We're terrible on that thing. I couldn't see through anything. And at the end of the day, it really wasn't the most comfortable vehicle. So it lacked power, lacked comfort, had horrible headlights and bad tires.
You know what else is good in the snow? The car that's sitting, well, they just picked it up, but we had it, the Pacifica all-wheel drive.
The Pacifica, actually drove that on a sheet of ice with my family in there.
Yeah, it's good in the snow.
And it was just regular all-season tires.
I did
tires
a snow drive in that thing. It's really
great.
Good. The biggest downside of that is you can't get the plug-in hybrid in an all-wheel drive. It's either plug-in hybrid or all-wheel drive.
Or standard front-wheel drive.
Right, in the plug-in hybrid, yeah. Which is a shame. I don't know why they don't just...
Well, I think that there's manufacturing issues, too, because they got to put a battery in it and a drive shaft.
Oh, so maybe that drive shaft, yeah.
Yeah, remember, they don't use the Toyota technology of powering the rear wheels with an electric motor. They just use this drive shaft going back to a mechanical rear end. But it was really good in the snow, and I think the way the weight is divided on that vehicle makes it very, very... flat in the snow. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel very rocky or anything. Yeah, I took it through some crazy Colorado snow and it did great.
And we've blown through our hour, Nathan, but
one
last car I want to talk about that was here, which I was just so impressed with and I think would be an excellent snow car, especially if you got the one with all the off-road tech. Because let's face it, if we take it into our ranch and it does well in the ranch, and by the way, a lot of you have been asking for the slip test.
Mm-hmm.
That Tommy does. It's coming back. We just finally were able to track down some more rollers. They arrived. They're sitting in a box. So more slip tests coming to show how the all-wheel drive system works. But the one that we took to the ranch that did really well, even though it didn't have all the off-road goodies, was a Lexus GX.
They're still building the GX?
Yeah.
I'll be damned.
Yeah, I drove it out there, and I was like, I just forgot how good this car is.
It's the last of the really capable off-road.
Go get
Lexus.
Yourself one before
they go away. Yeah. Because the LX, the big brother of it, is like it's got the big wheels.
I like the LX, but it's become too luxurious, right?
It's just a big, heavy.
It's a big,
luxury
barge, they got rid of. Unfortunately, in America, they got rid of Land Cruiser, so the LX now takes its place. But I would say go get it if you want the luxury. Heck yeah, LX is fine and it's good off road. But get yourself a GX.
Yeah, the GX. I've been seeing a lot more people taking the older ones and like tearing parts off them and making them serious off roaders. And it makes a lot of sense to me because you have the comfortable interior, and then you have the rugged exterior. You can do anything you want with it.
And you've got, you know, Toyota's reputation for reliability, which is what you want when you're driving around the world.
Yeah, well, those V8s are known as being bulletproof. So I would agree with you.
That's thirsty.
That's the other problem. We're not talking about economical here. Most four-wheel drive and all-wheel drive vehicles are not very economical. That's the bottom line.
Well, guys, there you have it. Thank you for spending this time with us.
That's a long broadcast, my friend.
Yeah, it was. We had a lot of discussions, and once again, check out alltfl.com if you want to see some of these videos we're talking about. And Nathan, thank you for taking the time today, and
no problem.
We'll see you guys next time. Ciao.
Cheers.
Oh, by the way, somebody wrote, and they made fun of me for saying ciao. That's like my sign off. You know why I say that?
Why?
Because I'm Czech, and I was born in the Czech Republic, as many of you probably know. And in the Czech Republic, ciao is just like, it's a hello and goodbye. It's just like, if you're with friends, you'd be like, ciao.
The Italians use that as well, right?
Yeah, but the Czechs also use it for some, I don't know why. But when you walk into a group of friends, you're like, ciao, or you leave, you're like, ciao. It's just, that's where it comes from. I'm not being pretentious. I'm not trying to be Italian. I'm just being what I am, which is Czech and ciao.
Okay. Auf Wiedersehen.
All right. Tschüss.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.